Start it for today. This is actually going to be kind of a short lecture because we're basically just finishing off chapter one, and then next week we're going to start on manifold, which is the chapter two stuff. So today I'm just going to focus on talking about classical field theory. And if anybody, I went through last time and I showed you other books that you can use to learn a little bit more about some of the stuff that we're going to be covering this semester. And for this, I think one of the really good resources for anything here that's unclear is to go back and look at Jackson, chapter 12. And basically that whole section, or that whole chapter is mostly going on field theory, and that's the chapter right after the one that goes over relativity. And if you go... you can also kind of go back and look at either Goldstein or any of the other classical mechanics texts, and that's kind of the same stuff. And so, meanwhile, once you've gotten this, you've gotten a lot of the stuff as far as... actually, I don't know if there's any problems on this stuff, but you should at least get the first part of the homework done. So, the idea... we're going to talk about classical field theory, and this is... I specify not quantum field theory. For those of you who are familiar with quantum field theory, it's not exactly the same thing. You just have to take this a step further and quantize it to get from classical to quantum field theory. And the idea is that when you go from special relativity to general relativity, you just replace this metric, this eta term, with this g, where this is a flat metric. It was just minus one and then one's down the diagonal. And in the metric... is actually a function of position. And it could be a function of position and time. And so it's a dynamic tensor field. And so that's something just to keep in mind as we kind of move these things along. And so we're not always going to be talking about just a simple Minkowski metric. Now, from the principle of least action, we know that action is defined... by this S here, and it's basically what happens when you integrate the Lagrangian over time, where the Lagrangian is defined to be the kinetic energy minus the potential energy, just like classical mechanics, and it's a function of position or coordinate and the time derivative coordinate. The idea being that if you know where a particle is and you know how it's moving, you could predict everywhere it's going to go. By using principle of least action in a potential field. And so if you take this action and you kind of look at variations in action and you set the variations to zero, so you end up with the least action or minimum action or principle of least action, you get this expansion of the Lagrangian in terms of derivatives. And they're partial derivatives with respect to position and respect to velocity, and you have a total derivative with respect to time here. And this is called the Euler-Lagrange equation. And so basically, the idea in everything in classical mechanics is if you can write a Lagrangian, and then you can basically put it into this Euler-Lagrange equation, then what you'll get out is the equations of motion describing how the particle works. And this basically works out as looking like a force equation. So if you take, for example, a Lagrangian, which is very simple, this is kinetic energy, effectively, we're taking mass equal to 1, minus potential energy, which is some function of position, then you plug it into the Euler-Lagrange equation, the result is going to be that acceleration goes like minus the... derivative of potential respect to position, which is the definition of acceleration. Now, the difference... so this is all just a review of classical mechanics. The difference in what you're going to do with field theory is that you're going to replace position with a field. In this case, this is a scalar. This is not just a scalar field. I actually put this actual the sigma on here. I don't know why I accidentally had this dot, but never mind that. But this is a function of position in space-time.
So this Greek indices mean all, both space and time. And this is a Greek indices, so that's space and time. So this field could be a field representing a four vector. And so it's got time-like and space-like components. And it also is a function of position and time. So if you look at electromagnetism as an example, and it's kind of going back to Jackson, you could see that this field, this vector field, is basically made up of the four vector potential, where this first part is like, you know, like charge potential or scalar potential, and the rest of them are like the normally what we think of as vector potential. And so if you write a field, especially a vector field, as opposed to having just a position, then what happens is, instead of having Lagrangian, you have what they call a Lagrangian density. And the basic idea is you have this Lagrangian density, which is a function of all these different vectors and all of their derivatives. And you integrate it over all of space, and you get something which is now just a function of time. And then you integrate that as over time, and you get back to action. So this Lagrangian density, which is a script L, has to be integrated over all four space-time dimensions, or over however many dimensions you have. And you, if you integrate over the spatial part, you're just left with the Lagrangian, and you integrate that over time, and you get, you know, just action. Now, before we go any further with this, I want to just point out the use of natural units. And this is something that you'll see in a lot of the text on field theory. And the basic idea is that we're lazy and we don't want to have to write any more than we have to. And so if you take the speed of light to be equal to 1, and you take Planck's constant and Boltzmann's constant to both be equal to 1, and that's just, you know, h over 2 pi, then you can create this system where energy, mass are the same because E equals mc squared. You can have length and time are effectively the same. And mass is like inverse length, because if you think about it, since high frequency is high energy, and frequency is inverse time, so that makes sense. So we can basically put energy, mass, length, time, all the different things on kind of the same scaling, and not. And then when we need to convert from, say, time to energy, we can just throw in Planck's constant or speed of light or whatever we need to convert between them. So action in this case, as you could see, Lagrangian is basically energy, since it's kinetic energy minus potential energy. And you're integrating it over time. So the action is actually just energy times time. Energy is inverse time. So if you multiply the two together, you're going to get something dimensionless. So action is dimensionless in this natural units. And so we can think of dimensionless as being like mass to the zero. And you'll notice in this textbook, we're going to use mass a lot as sort of the measure. I mean, in my research, you know, we're doing fluid, cosmological fluids. I actually use length as the measure, like meters. So everything is kind of measured in meters. But when you do, like, say, a black hole simulation, everything scales with the mass of the black hole. So everything is done in terms of mass. So a lot of the stuff you'll see traditionally in general relativity, everything is done in terms of mass. And then you double the mass or triple the mass or go up by a factor of a million, and everything scales accordingly. And so here, we could say that action is like mass to the zero power, and therefore it's dimensionless. This integral is basically length to the fourth power, or length cubed times time, and that goes like inverse mass. Goes inverse mass to the fourth. And so therefore, we notice Lagrangian density should also be like mass to the fourth. and this comes out as dimensionless. And so you basically, if you do everything in natural units, you know that this is kind of the way things should look, and then you can come up with your Euler Lagrange equations or the equivalents of that. And so we do look at variations in the field, and it's not as simple as doing variations in the Lagrangian, because what happens here is that you've got your field, your vector field here, and it is basically the original field plus some perturbation. It's not like position where you just, well, yeah, position plus some variation. And the more dimensions you add on, the harder this gets. And so when you look at the variation, the derivative of the field, that is like taking the derivative of the original field plus the derivative of the variation of the field. And what happens here is that you could see you can, the derivative commutes with this variation. And so you can kind of flip the order of those two around. And then you can just think of this, since derivative is a linear operator, is just the derivative of all of the field and the variation. So we have to do basically calculus of variations, which, you know, is explained a lot in classical mechanics, and then you also see it in Arfkin and Weber and other textbooks. But what happens then is when you want to look at your variation in your Lagrangian density, then you have your Lagrangian density here. And you have, it basically becomes the field with the variation. And then you also have this other term, which is the derivative of the field with the variation. And so that, you can then think of it as like a linear operator, and you can kind of separate out the variations out of Lagrangian using calculus of variations. And you could see that this is basically the Lagrangian you started with. And then you also have this term, which is a derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the field, and then the variation in the field, and then the derivative of the Lagrangian density with respect to the gradient or the change in the field, and then its variation. And so the action also becomes the action plus whatever the delta is on the action. And so the delta on the action, since the action was just basically the integral of just this term by itself, the Lagrangian density, the variation on the action is the integral of all of this stuff. So we just say that the delta of the action is the integral, the four integral, of all of this other stuff. And so you got this thing, and now you do integration by parts, which you never get away from no matter how far you go in physics. And you could see that integration by parts has takes this second term here, and it makes it into two terms. One, where you have basically the derivative moving from being on the variation to being a derivative of all of this stuff except for the variation. And then the other term ends up being a total derivative of the variation and the derivative of the Lagrangian density. And it kind of makes sense that, you know, these, from the chain rule, this should work. And so this is a total derivative, and so we can use Stokes' theorem here. And so when we do that, out at infinity, you're assuming you're integrating this all the way out to infinity, terms disappear. And then you do integration by parts again. And you do it again, and you do it again. And eventually, what you get is we have the first term, which is here, and you can see you got the delta of the field. And then the second term, which is basically this term here. And so, and it's because these terms, when you apply the Stokes theorem, end up vanishing at infinity. And so the minus sign comes from this minus sign. And so the this effectively becomes your Euler-Lagrange equation. And since the delta of the action is basically just taking the derivative of the action with respect to something and then integrating it, then we can also write this in a little bit different way. And you could see here what we've done is we say, well, if we take the delta of the action with respect to the field, or the delta of the field, and then we integrate over the delta of the field, this should give us back delta of the action. And so you can basically compare this equation to this equation and see that all the terms are alike except for this term must be equal to all of this. So the delta of the action with respect to delta of the field is equal to this stuff, which is like the Euler-Lagrange equation, which is equal to zero. But either way, you know that if this is equal to zero, and this delta here is not really doing anything, then this has to be equal to zero. So this is like your Euler-Lagrange equation. Because you want you have the principle of least action, which says that the action has to be minimized. And so that's all we're going by. That's the only reason why we know it has to be zero. It's not a it's not a law of least action, it's just a principle. I mean, and the whole idea of field theory, is my understanding of it, is that basically what they're trying to do is they're trying to say, well, this works for classical objects, and therefore it must work for fields. I mean, there's not really anything that says that it has to work the same way, because fields are more abstract, but they're basically saying, you know, same thing. Let's just pretend they work. And they apply it, and it works. And really, you know, using field theory, you can effectively derive Maxwell's equations. You can derive general relativity. You can, they use it a lot in theoretical physics for a lot of trying to understand the motions of particles. And even like in string theory or something like that. So it works. It's just not obvious why it works and why it should work for a field instead of working, you know, like it works for particles. Okay. So that was the whole idea of quantum field theory and how the principle, or classical field theory, and how the whole principle works here. So what we're going to do now is we're going to look at a real scalar field, since this is the simplest example, and we're going to look at how it works there and then kind of expand that into talking about vector fields again, since you saw the full vector field example. So you start off with a scalar field. You notice there's no indice here on phi, and it's a function of position and time. And it's basically space-time, and it's just mapping space-time to a real number. Trust me, next week you're going to be sick of me saying the word mapping, so just get used to it now. Now, upon quantization of a field, the idea is that if you take a field and you quantize it, you can get particles out of it. So that's why it is you have, like, you know, a field like the electromagnetic field, which is carried by a photon, and they can equate the photon to the electromagnetic field. And it's a particle physics thing. But it does work, and that's one of the arguments as far as why you can sort of do this stuff. And if you look at quantum mechanics, I mean, you've got momentum, and you've got position. And they kind of use these to equate them to fields of each. And if you do Fourier transforms, you flip between one and the other. So this is sort of the argument about why this stuff works, even though it's still not completely clear. If you take a scalar field, it's going to equate to a spinless particle. And an example of that, again, is, let's see, a spin zero field would be like the Higgs field and then to the Higgs boson. I think the photons have like spin one, so that doesn't quite work. If you have vector or tensor fields, then you get higher spin particles. And so, for example, fermions have a half spin, and they would be represented by spinner fields, which is another object that we're not going to discuss in this class, but it's something between a scalar and a vector, if you want to think of it like that. And you can actually have two spinner fields that can orientate and look like a scalar field. And then if you have something like a photon, you know, it's a vector field, and that is going to relate to a spin 1 particle. And gravitational fields, like, you know, curvature of space-time or whatever we think about it, in the particle physics world, they're tensors because they're tensor fields. In the particle physics world, they actually relate to spin 2 particles. And so the graviton is a spin 2 particle that nobody's ever seen before. And then a complex field, you know, we have an imaginary part, actually relates to a particle and an antiparticle. So you can basically, like this, you can just kind of go back and forth between these particles and fields. And again, it's like, it's one of these things that either I don't know all the math behind it or the whole proof behind it, but it's something that works. Now, if we have a real scalar field, then let's say we have kinetic energy, or lack of a better term, kinetic energy, which is described as taking 1/2 times the time derivative of the scalar field squared. And we're going to have the gradient energy, which is going to be 1/2 times the gradient of this thing. And the potential energy is just going to be written as V is a function of phi. So we're basically, you can almost just replace phi with position, and it looks just like a classical particle. So you notice that these are not the Lorentz invariant forms for kinetic energy and gradient energy. Gradient energy we just kind of invented because it's, you know, instead of time derivative, a spatial derivative. But the potential should be Lorentz invariant. And by that I mean, if you look at a particle from one observer's point of view, he's traveling one speed, and another observer's point of view is traveling a different speed, they're both going to agree on what the potential is, because the position is not going to really, with respect to the potential well, is not going to really change. But these are definitely going to be different for different observers. And so in order to make this Lorentz invariant, we actually have to write it like this. And what happens is, and this is kind of clever, we're assuming flat space-time, so you can actually just replace this with a metric term. And you could see that mathematically this should give you this. But in writing it this way, as opposed to this way, you kind of allow things to switch between being a time derivative and a spatial derivative and vice versa, which is what happens when you go from one reference frame to another. Because one person might see him not moving at all, another might see him moving 5 meters per second. But this lets you switch between them. It's therefore Lorentz invariant. So when we do these Lagrangian densities, we want things to be Lorentz invariant. Because that way you can switch between observers, and we can switch to like a generalized space-time or whatever. And the Lagrangian density is then written like this. We have our Lorentz invariant kinetic energy and gradient energy. And then you have your potential, which is already Lorentz invariant. And so this, you'll notice, each one of these terms is goes like mass to the 1, mass to the first power. And this is like mass to the 4th. And so what happens is I think you get the metric term itself, which goes like inverse distance. I think that picks up another couple factors of mass.
How can you tell if something is Lorentz invariant?
That's a good question. You have to kind of look at it in two different ways. You actually have to look at it and think, well, the one thing that changes is velocity when you go from one reference frame to another. And so you have to think, if you change the velocity, as if you're changing the time or how time works? And if you were to do a Lorentz transform, do you get the same answer?
The first one's obviously
not. Right. And it basically, it's a time derivative. If you change time, you're going to get a different answer. So you can almost imagine, instead of having d phi dt, put in d phi gamma dt. And you see that it's not going to be the same. And then, meanwhile, this gradient energy has got the same problem.
Because of
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so you have to kind of look at that. And, you know, the interesting thing is, like, you even look at plasma physics equations or the Navier-Stokes equation. And there is a difference between the way we're normally used to seeing it and the Lorentz invariant way of it. And that's why you can tell us the difference between relativistic fluids and non-relativistic fluids. Okay. So the derivative of the Lagrangian density respect to phi is just going to be the derivative of potential respect to phi with a minus sign. And the derivative with respect to velocity is really easy. As you can see, it's just taking the derivative of one of these two terms, which gives you the other one. So taking the derivatives here is incredibly easy. And then your derivative of the action with respect to the field is just given by the Euler equation. And so when you plug that in, you have the derivative, partial derivative of this, which is, like you could see, that it ends up being a second derivative of this term, which we write as box. So the box term is kind of like an operator, which effectively ends up looking like minus the second derivative with respect to time plus the second derivative with respect to whatever spatial dimensions you've got. And so it is, or del squared. And so it's effectively like your wave number operator, or your wave operator. So, yeah, it's like a wave and an operator. And so this term right here is just coming from up here. And we want to put the positive terms first because it looks better. And so you add these together, you got least action, so this is equal to zero. And so effectively this is a wave in your field, and then you got your potential term, which is just kind of sitting there. Oh, here? Yeah, TT. Yeah. Yeah, second derivative with respect to time. So when you expand this out, you've got second derivative with respect to time minus the second derivative with respect to space, or Laplacian, and then your derivative of this. And so it's basically like a wave, but with a force term on it in flat space. And you can do this in generalized space by just changing that metric term. And the nice thing about it is when you change this metric term from flat space to curved space, if it's Lorentz invariant, it still works. So you can go from a flat geometry to a generalized geometry, just like that. And so you can, you know, so you can convert from something just a regular equation to a relativistic form, which works in curved space, really neat. So if you take this potential and you say it's equal to 1/2 mass squared times phi squared, then what happens is when you take this derivative here, a potential, you end up getting mass squared phi, and you have phi here equals zero. And this is known as the Klein-Gordon equation. And it can be used, it's something that kind of pops up a lot in field theory, but M in this case can be used to describe, different types of scalar fields. Now, then there's the electromagnetic field example, and this is almost the same example that you'll see in Jackson. Not much difference here. But you could see that you've got your electromagnetic field tensor, but here it's written in terms of the vector potentials, or the four vector potentials. So this is the easiest way to write it. And I know after Jackson, some of you guys will never forget that. So if you take this vector potential, this four-vector potential, when you expand it out by basically adding in the gradient of something. And this is like, you can think of this as a gauge choice, or you can think of it as just some perturbation or whatever. Then you'll notice that you're basically, if it's given this term, then the electromagnetic field tensor becomes the old electromagnetic field tensor plus, you have these derivative terms, second derivative here. And then it basically, because these commute, these two cancel each other out. And you end up back with the electromagnetic field tensor, which means that this is sort of like what we call the gauge choice. And so you can add in whatever kind of gauge you want to make the math work easier. And you also see that when you do that anti-symmetrizing thing like we did before on the electromagnetic field tensor and its derivatives, then it ends up giving you this minus this, which is equal to zero, and everything works. So when you do the field theory with the electromagnetic field tensor, you're actually going to take derivatives of Lagrangian density with respect to each term in the four-vector potential. And so that gives you this Euler-Lagrange equation. And if you take this Lagrangian density and you take it to be equal to this, where this is basically saying that this is like the kinetic energy part of the electromagnetic field, or, you know, and then this is coming from the scalar potential part, or sorry, the potential part. I think I got that mixed up. Yeah, I have it mixed up. This is actually from like the kinetic energy part, because it's basically particles that are moving. And this comes from sort of like the energy of the field, because you basically have electric field squared and magnetic field squared. So it kind of looks like, you know, you could think of it that way. But effectively, it's going to work out the other way, because this is going to have all the derivatives of the vector potential, and this is just going to have the vector potential by itself. So if you take the derivative of that Lagrangian density with respect to the four-vector potential here, it only affects this term, because these terms are all going to involve the derivatives of the four-vector potential. In which case, you end up with just a delta function here and the current, and then that just gives you the current. Meanwhile, for these two terms, for the electromagnetic field tensors, it's basically almost like you have the two of these, and then you're just using a couple metrics to raise the indice. And then when you take the derivative of that with respect to the derivative or the vector potential, it's basically what's happening here is you're taking the derivative of one of these with respect to the derivative of the vector potential plus the other one by the chain rule. And when you do that, you'll notice you've got here partial mu, partial a, partial nu, and these are all alpha, beta, rho, sigma. So what happens here is that either if alpha is equal to mu and beta is equal to nu, then you get something that's going to work. Otherwise, they're different. And so you end up getting this series of delta functions, because this is basically saying alpha is mu, beta is nu, or could be the other way around. Beta is mu, alpha is nu. And there's a minus sign here because this is anti-symmetric. And so it's neat because you end up replacing these derivative terms here with a series of delta functions, and you could see that this is now what you get. So you have all these delta functions, and you have the metric terms, and then you have the other stuff in the chain rule. And then what happens is that when you apply the metrics with the delta functions, that's when things get interesting. Because effectively, this is anti-symmetric. And these terms are symmetric. So what you do is you go through and you just apply them one at a time and see what happens. And so you can see here that alpha and nu are the same, and beta and nu. So that's going to give you this term from the first one. And then this with the beta is going to be this one. And then you're subtracting this one, which is the other way around. And then you have your field tensor. And then down here, you've got this one. You're going to end up with summing over rho. So you're going to have, instead of alpha, so you're going to have alpha nu, or alpha mu here. And then you're going to have, from this one, summing over sigma instead of beta. So you're going to have beta and nu. And then the inverse here. And then you go through and you apply the raising or lowering indices caused by the metric. So you end up raising this indice to be mu, raising this indice here to be nu, and then this one does it the opposite way around. So you have the other way around. And then here you got raising this alpha indice to be mu, raising the beta indice here to be nu. Raising the beta indice to be nu, and then the other way around. And what happens is, this is exactly the opposite of that one. But they're anti-symmetric, and they're flipped around. So these two are actually the same, and so this is actually two times this. And then these two, same thing, and so you end up getting four times this field tensor, which gives you this. And so a lot of this was just tensor gymnastics, and it's the kind of thing you're going to have to work through in this course. So therefore, when you took the derivative of the Lagrangian density with respect to this, you end up getting minus the field tensor, which is basically just it's basically just from taking this term, but we also have to keep in mind that we had this minus 1/4 here, and so that gives you just the minus field tensor. And you've got this term, which was just the current. And so the net result is you can kind of combine these two together and see that the Euler equation is just going to be coming from the combination of these two. So you've got this derivative, which is coming from taking the derivative of this guy, is going to be minus this current, which comes from up here, is going to be your Euler-Lagrange equation, and you can see that this is effectively Maxwell's equations. So we've derived Maxwell's equations by solving the Euler-Lagrange equations for a electromagnetic field. So it works. Doesn't seem like it should work, but it works. And you know, and you can basically use that to solve for any field. Now the energy momentum tensor for a scalar field is, in this case, you have a scalar E&M tensor, mass stress energy tensor or energy tensor, and you've got this scalar field written in a Lorentz invariant way. And then you've got this term, which is, I guess, just to subtract off the other half. It's just a rewriting of it's just basically a rewriting of this right here. So they've kind of broken it up into two parts as opposed to having it just as one piece. And then you've got the potential here. which is coming from this right here. And so, and you could see that there's a difference here, and that what they did was basically to go from the Lagrangian to get to the stress energy tensor. It's the same way you go from talking about the Lagrangian to talking about the Hamiltonian, where you basically just take some term here, which looks like 2 times your kinetic energy. You might remember this from classical mechanics. 2 times your kinetic energy minus your Lagrangian ends up giving you kinetic energy plus potential energy. And so that's basically what they did right here. And so this would be like your energy for your field, for a scalar field. And then for the electromagnetic field tensor, for an electromagnetic field, you've got the electromagnetic field. And so you kind of take this kinetic energy part, and then you just subtract off the Lagrangian, or 2 times that. And you'll see that what happens effectively is that when you take the derivative of this EM field tensor, or any of these field tensors, you'll get zero, meaning that you have conservation of energy, or conservation of energy momentum. And in a Lorentz invariant world, what happens is sometimes energy might not be conserved because it leaks into momentum, and sometimes momentum is not conserved because it leaks into energy. And by conserving the four momentum or energy momentum, everything works. So, anyway, I skipped a little bit to talk about that, but that's where we are. Any questions?
Nope.
Okay. Like I said, this was going to be a short one, so you get at least one a semester. Don't expect it all the time. Okay. All right. While I'm here, are there any questions on the homework?
Nope.
Okay. All right. So next time I'm going to continue on and talk about manifolds, which this stuff I've been covering the first 3 lectures, I consider review. But as far as when we get into stuff about manifolds, that's stuff that should be new to pretty much everybody in the room. So if there's any questions come up on that, let me know. And I suggest, doing a little bit of reading ahead on that stuff. And
this stuff was reviewed today?
You had a lot of this in Electro. Yeah. I didn't say it was an easy review. I didn't say we're going to teach you how to do 2 plus 2 or anything like that. But this was all stuff that I expected you guys have been at least a little bit exposed to. It probably, it's like Green's functions. Sometimes students black them out because it's just been such a traumatic experience. And, so you may not know that you know this stuff, but you do know this stuff from Chapter 1. My Chapter 2 is going to be different. So, all right, so any other questions? Okay.